The following is presented by the Cheeky Bastards.
Brace for impact, buckaroos, because your skulls are about to take a gargantuan blast of action-packed jackassery to the fucking ear holes. An audio explosion so mind-numbing extreme, protective headwear should be mandatory to listen to this level of inane horseshit. So lock and load, buttercups, and prepare your tiny minds for your monthly assault of grade-A action movie mayhem, filled with enough high-octane carnage, insane shootouts, and nose-busting fisticuffs that Michael Bay himself would weep like the little product placement bitch that he is. Now duck and cover, my little cupcakes, because it's time for the Men of Action Podcast, a show packed with enough testosterone-filled bravado it could take down a small nation. So here are your hosts, those cheeky bastards themselves. From America, it's the notorious Scott K. And from England, it's the cynical Mr. Smith. They may be secret meat, but you can bet your ass they're packing some serious fucking heat. Shit's about to get explosive.
Hidey ho, you slack John sons of bitches, and welcome to the Cheeky Bastards Are the Men of Action Podcast. I'm the notorious Scott K.
And from the UK, this is Mr. Smith.
And we will be your cantankerous, opinionated hosts on this monthly action-filled quest where we pit two kick-ass action films from an action star or action director's catalog against one another in a no-holds-barred battle to the death to see which one truly reigns supreme. And what better way to celebrate the month devoted to love than with a brotherly beatdown between Tony and Ridley Scott to see which Scott is the favorite son and which is just a son of a bitch. But before we board a flight to Japan with our daughter's cat puppet, it is my pleasure to welcome in my curmudgeonly host. From the UK, it is Mr. Steve Smith. How are you today, Mr. Smith? And what are your Valentine's Day plans as when this drops, we'll be so close to the love boat day of... I'm 6 weeks after Christmas. Holy fuck. Not even a chance to breathe or recoup from spending money at Christmas. It's like, hey, give me more gifts, motherfucker.
Well, as my ex-girlfriend said to me, and this is true, by the way, she said, when we split up, she said the words... She said the words, "You are not capable of love."
Wow.
Although my reply was...
I'll see you next Tuesday.
my reply was, I am capable of paying the bills, though, aren't I? Ooh. But anyway, that's a whole other story. But yeah, so I'll just be... I don't do Valentine's Day because no one loves me.
Well, then that leads me to another question. How much one-on-one time will you spend with yourself in this month of love?
Me and my right hand will be having a very pleasant
just me, myself,
together.
And I. It's a threesome.
No complaints, clear the mess up, you know, everyone's happy.
Only got to pay for one dinner, boom.
Hey. That's enough of that.
Gee, I don't know why we'd have more female listeners on this podcast. I can't figure out what it could be.
I can't fathom it. I can't fathom it.
Oh, yeah, so hope all of you out there will find some love, whether it's with yourself or with someone else, just as long as it's consensual, folks. Make sure it's consensual, because when you don't, you find out what non-consensual love is later on in the old prison system, depending on where you are in the world. Sometimes it's even worse in other parts of the world than just here in America. So be consensual, folks, or someone else will make you the stuffing of a pillow.
Oh.
No.
I don't know what to say of that. I know.
How about we move on into our lovely Valentine's Day gifts to all our listeners, being our monthly recommendations.
It's time for the Cheeky Bastards monthly movie or show recommendations.
Jimmy, this some serious gourmet shit.
Now, it is an even month, which means an even episode anyways. Our 18th, we're a year and a half into the podcast. Pretty impressive, halfway through season number 2. We've changed format ideas a couple of times, but hey, what are you going to do? We're old. But we're going to start with some recommendations. And for me, my recommendation this month is once again a TV show.
Ooh.
By the time I record this, the final episode is actually on tonight. By the time you listen to this, folks, it will be out officially. And it is Fargo Season 5, which is from FX. And I believe in the UK, you can find that on your version of Hulu, which is Disney Plus. That's where you can find it. Now, the latest installment of Fargo is set once again in Minnesota and North Dakota in the year 2019. After an unexpected series of events lands Dorothy Dot Lyon, played by the amazing Juno Temple, who some may know from Ted Lasso. She finds herself in hot water with the authorities. The seemingly typical Midwestern housewife is suddenly plunged back into a life she thought she had left behind. However, North Dakota Sheriff Roy Tillman, played with delicious villainy by John Hamm, has been searching for Dot for a very long time. He's a rancher, preacher, and a constitutional lawman. Roy believes that he is the law and therefore is above the law. At his side is his loyal but feckless son, Gator, played by Joe Carey. For those of you who don't know, he is in the show. He plays Steve in Stranger Things, and he is spectacular. We'll get him in a minute. His son is desperate to prove himself to his larger-than-life father, but when it comes to hunting Dot, Roy must enlist Old Munch, a shadowy drifter of mysterious origin. With her deepest secrets beginning to unravel, Dot attempts to shield her family from her past, but her doting, well-meaning husband, Wayne, keeps running to his mother, Lorraine Lyon, played by the cunt of all cunts from The Hateful Eight herself, Jennifer Jason Leigh. A CEO of the largest debt collection agency in the country, the Queen of Debt, is unimpressed with her son's choice in wives and spares no opportunity to voice her disapproval. However, Dot has an uncanny knack for survival, and with her back to the wall, she's about to show why one should never provoke a mother lion. Now, the newest season of FX anthology series, inspired by the Coen Brothers movie of the same name, like the movie, claims to be based on true events. However, that too is a lie. It's just a cheeky way to lend the neo-North mayhem to ensue a kind of arc true crime fidelity. Yet, it does tap into some modern-day truths as it portrays the ways we bend our perception of reality to our whims, despite all evidence to the contrary. The events themselves may not be true, but the story explores a kind of universal truth that's part and parcel of the human experience, self-delusion. And so it goes with the fifth season of Holly Strange, fascinating reinvention of the Coens' neo-noir impulses, one of the series' most assured and entertaining yarns yet. This started just around Thanksgiving here in America, and we'll be finishing tonight where we are in America in mid-January. Well, you listen to this in mid-February. It'll have been a month in the can. It has been spectacular to a point where the three main stars of the series, Juno, John, and Joe, all have already made names for themselves in other series. Obviously, Juno is fresh off her three-season starring role in Ted Lasso. John Hamm from Mad Men, and we'll get to him in a second. And then Joe Carey, who's played Steve on Stranger Things and will finish his role there this next time it comes out in season five, the final year. They have been so against what you know them as. They're completely against type of what we have come to know each character, each actor to play. John Hamm is fucking deliciously evil. He plays this constitutional U.S. lawman from North Dakota. This is so in touch with what's kind of the MAGA stuff going on here in America. Steve, you'd love it just for his performance alone. His performance is spectacular.
I love John Hamm.
And for this season, what they've done over the other seasons is they have really paid a lot of homage to the original movie.
Right.
There's a similar thing, like there's a break-in. The guys kind of look like the Steve Buscemi and what's-his-name character. They do a lot of kind of mirroring some things that have happened, but it's completely different. A very strong cast, a very amazing, amazing show. I've been enthralled since I started watching it, and I've only, I think, highlighted three other shows, so
yeah.
I highly recommend this to you. You will love it, and the great thing, it's an anthology. You get the 10 episodes out, and you put it to bed.
That's it. I'm a big fan.
This is certified gourmet.
And I can't even tell you how it ends because right now I'm waiting for tonight's show to figure it out.
I'm a big fan of that. I'm a big fan of just a series, you know, just a one-off series. I don't need seven seasons. Yeah. Everything becomes so formulaic. Although I will say Mad Men is up there with my favorite shows of all time. And every season of Fargo, I think every season's been great.
Yes, but that's the nice thing is they don't really interconnect with each other, which is except for season
there's
one,
little,
season two.
There's again. Little Easter eggs dotted
yes,
in there,
but it's great.
But they're their own thing, mm-hmm. and I think they've all been superb. And I haven't seen a second of the new season, so I like to wait. But I always like to wait till they're done, and then I can kind of.
Well, tomorrow they'll be done. They'll be done for you tomorrow because they'll be all in the can.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I binge it, but I kind of. You know, I like to watch a couple of episodes a night, you know, just watch it over like a week. And I'm really excited anyway.
Yeah, it was well done. I think this might be his last one because he's moving on to the Alien series now.
Yes. Yes. So we've got the Alien series and we've got a new Alien movie by Fede Alvarez as well.
So if he's coming out with this and he's putting it to bed on this one, he's He's putting it out in a good... I mean, it's going, out in great. Yes, 100%.
Well, no, I'm even more excited now that's got your endorsement, so I shall get right on it.
Now, Mr. Smith, what is your Valentine's Day love letter to us that we should partake in on this season of love and flu?
Well, we go from a neo-noir series to a kind of redneck noir movie. So this is Mobland from 2003, directed by a guy called Nicholas Maggio. Now, the story... But it's deep in the heart of Dixie, in a small town struggling with the ravages of drug addiction, a local sheriff, played by John Travolta, tries to maintain the peace when desperate family man Shelby, played by Shiloh Fernandez, robs an illegal pill operation with his reckless brother-in-law Trey, played by Kevin Dillon. But the supposedly easy score takes a violent turn, which compels the New Orleans Mafia to send in sadistic enforcer Clayton Miner, Stephen Dorff, to clean up the mess. So we've got a kind of cross between, say, No Country for Old Men.
Okay.
You know, I mean, a formulaic kind of, you know, heist goes wrong and then they send some badass to clean up the mess. Literally, you know, what you want. Really. And I think Stephen Dorff, Kevin Dillon, and Shiloh Fernandez, who is the brother, who plays the brother in the Evil Dead remake, not Evil Dead Rise.
Okay. The one you like, not the one you... That was the worst movie of the year.
The other one I liked from 10 years ago. But Shiloh Fernandez, Kevin Dillon, and Stephen Dorff, they all came on board as producers for the movie. Now, I'm assuming they probably got hold of the script and they, you know, they wanted in on this movie.
So Mr. Johnny T.
John Travolta, I mean. Mr. Reliable. Yes. You know, he's just that. Really, the MVP, the revelation is Stephen Dorff to me. He's kind of the guy from No Country for Old Men.
Like an Anton Chigurh type.
Yeah, but he's got a bit more of a conscience and he talks a lot. He's a lot more talkative, you know. You know, Travolta's kind of he's kind of lurking in the background. Like, does he know what's going on? You know, he's the sheriff of the town and he's a bit of a good old boy. And it's like, is he a bit, not simple in that regard, but a bit kind of like, these kind of things don't really happen around here. Bodies don't pile up around here. You know, we're just a small town. But then the bodies do start piling up, and that's like, is he going to cotton on to what's actually happening? You know, this Nicholas Maggio, he's, I think, someone to watch. This guy could, you know, given a budget, this guy could do something decent. Because this movie, you know, it doesn't reinvent the wheel, but it's a good, it's a solid example of a kind of modern crime movie.
Well, it's kind of like our journey with Bruce. Obviously, it's one of those kind of like direct-to-DVD video rentals. And it's one of those ones that kind of surprise you. You're not the first person to say Mobland is a decent film. Like, I've seen a couple people through our social sites saying the same thing. It's on here, right. Like I said, it's on Hulu here, so I'm going to check it out. But I've been hearing good things about it. I was kind of like, you know, I got to give this and now you're recommending it, so boom.
This is certified gourmet.
It's almost like you're puzzled that you like it.
We've been on this journey, haven't we?
You know what I mean? Well, yeah, we have. Yeah, you're almost a bit like, is it just me or was that just a really solid little movie? That, you know, ticked all the boxes and it done everything extremely well. Like I say, Travolta's Mr. Reliable. Mm-hmm. You know, Stephen Dorff is just, I mean, I'm a big fan of his anyway. He's another one, you know, he's another one like Travolta. He's always good.
Yeah.
He's just not always in very good movies.
Well, I think he got a real good chance when he was with Mahershala Ali in season three of True Detective. I thought he was spectacular in that, you know, and I'm surprised he hasn't gotten more from it because he was really good.
And, you know, and hey, he's an old man now, you know, he's an older guy now. Yeah, and he just does a really good job of this kind of charismatic, you know, mob enforcer. I'm guessing, I don't know, is Clayton Miner, like Claymore Mines? I don't know. Is that? I don't know if that's some play on that.
Hey, he's the younger brother. He would have been Clayton Major, but he's second in time. We send Clayton Major, you're really fucked, all right? We're sending Miner.
Yeah, there's some actually... You know, there's some decent, like, needle drops in the movie as well, some good music. Mm. Dialogue-wise, it's not the Tarantino-y vibe, but it's not it doesn't do that, but it's just a well-written, very well-directed, and very well-acted little, you know, little movie that, you know, you look at the front cover, you know, don't judge a book by its cover, definitely in this case. And even the name, you know, that generic name, but... A surprising little movie. I just recommend it. I'll recommend it to anyone who'll listen. I've been fairly evangelical about it anyway. So here we are. You know, this is my recommendation for the month, definitely.
Well, there you go. Get yourself on a little Mobland. And then if you want to see a little bit of the Coen brothers being reinvented, get yourself on a season. I mean, it's wintertime. If you're listening to us in the northern hemisphere.
Yeah, you're not going.
If you're in the southern hemisphere, you're like, fuck you. I'm going to the beach looking at some ass and cheeks. I get you. But if you're not in the southern hemisphere and you're in the northern hemisphere, you can sit down, binge watch on a weekend, a couple of Fargo season 5, and then watch yourself Mobland. And boom, especially if you're alone, you know, you don't always need somebody on this time of year. Save your money. Don't get sick. Boom. Cheeky Bastards are here for you.
Now
we're here to also shit on some people's parade. However, also give you a little bit. I'd like to think this is like a PSA, or it's a public service announcement for you. These are the things you should not fucking let your eyeballs go across. We did accidentally, and we did that for you.
We're here to save you time and money.
Exactly. And thankfully, I didn't spend any money on the one I watched.
This is some serious horse shit.
Horse shit.
Horse shit.
Horse shit.
And this is horse shit.
Horse shit. Horse shit.
It's horse shit. Horse shit. Horse shit. Horse shit. Yes.
And it's not going to be a surprise. I'm about to take a shit on something that's been taking a shit on since it debuted in late December. And it does hurt me a little bit because this director is someone who has early on made some really good movies. We've got the remake of Dawn of the Dead. We got 300, Man of Steel. I mean, he's had some good early films. Mr. Zack Snyder took a big old fucking peanut buttery, sloppy green, runny shit all over us at Christmas time with Rebel Moon Part 1, A Child of Fire. Now, a little backstory on this fucking hot dog crap. This was originally going to be an actual Star Wars standalone film when he first wrote it. So, knowing that when you go into it and you start watching it, you realize this is the biggest Star Wars ripoff you've ever seen, and it is absolute dog shit. So, without a doubt, this is probably one of the worst Hollywood blockbusters made in the last decade. And this is something that my good friend Steve has also harped on. We've talked about some of the movies we watch on our Bruce Willis journey of the direct-to-DVD movies he puts out, where some of those have been crappy but not bad, and they haven't spent the budget that some of these big fucking, I don't know how much Netflix spent on this, but it is a turd pile. And they spent a turd mile of money for it. Which is why it's so befuddling of a movie that it will leave audiences asking who decided to make this steaming pile of turd horseshit and who thought it was a good idea in the fucking first place. Some might even question who the fuck keeps giving Zack Snyder money to make horseshit like this. Everything from the dialogue to cinematography looks like it came out of a video game cut screen. The majority of this poor man's Star Wars action sequences look like a fanboy got hold of a camcorder and shot a shitload of Matrix-style action scenes that quickly become annoying and nauseating. It truly feels like they started filming this turd burger and then midway through decided to write a plot based on fanfiction Star Wars movies. Every unremarkable actor in this film looks like they're reciting lines in a hostage video. Makes sense why this movie wasn't financed by a major studio and instead produced by Netflix, who should at this point just be called B-Flix. And to make matters worse, there's a fucking sequel coming out to this green-hued pile of horse caca this spring. If you thought Snyder's Sucker Punch was shit, well, I'm here to tell you this cocksucker is a Jurassic Park dinosaur-sized pile of green turdy horse shit in comparison. Now, if the thought ever crosses your mind to check this piece of shit out to see what all the fuss is about, what we here at the Cheeky Bastards would like you to do is ball one of your hands up into a tight fist and punch yourself squarely in the genitals, because that will be a far less painful experience than watching Zack Snyder's Part 1 of his Rebel Moon sequel, A Child of Fire.
Wow.
This is certified horseshit.
It has been dogpiled by a lot of people.
That's true.
It is an unbelievable ripoff of Star Wars. However, in fairness, it was originally supposed to be some kind of Star Wars standalone movie called Rebel Moon.
That's right.
And here's the fun part. Apparently, in the second one, that's when you actually get to the supposed Rebel Moon. There is no Rebel Moon in the first movie. There's no Rebel Moon at all. And no child is on fire, which was disappointing because at some point I was like, maybe a child would get on fire. It might have brought it up. All right, Mr. Smith. What else should we keep the fuck away from in February 2024?
Well, by now, this is going to be yesterday's papers, I guess. And I'm going to keep this shorter than... It's kind of ridiculous that I'm going to keep this shorter than what you've just said, considering the caliber of who's involved. I haven't even written any notes for this, but we're talking about Ridley Scott's Napoleon.
He may be on this episode.
Yeah, mate, yeah. This movie is just a bloated mess that really, I mean, I think Joaquin Phoenix is miscast, for starters. The writing was on the wall when I saw the trailer, and they weren't even bothering to even use French accents. Okay, I'm not going to, for a big blockbuster like this, I'm not going to expect them to all be speaking in French and have subtitles all the way through it. That's too much to ask. But when you've got soldiers on horses charging at each other, yelling Vive la France in American accents, you know, the writing's on the wall. You know, is it a character study?
Hey, yo,
is
Pierre, it a romance? Vive la France, you motherfucker.
Hey, you fucking cock-sucking French piece of shit over here.
Would that have made it better if they did a Sopranos version of it?
I would have loved it. You know I would. But what I was going to say was, you know, is it a character study? Is it a romance? Is it a epic war movie? Ridley Scott doesn't commit to any of these things. And it's just... It's actually, right, okay, so the battle scenes, I'll give him credit for the battle scenes. They're pretty horrific, pretty epic, well shot. But, you know, saying a Ridley Scott movie is well shot is kind of like redundant at this point. You know, the man who made Gladiator, Blade Runner.
Alien.
Exactly, yeah. You know. I mean, what you should do is go back and watch his debut movie, The Duelist, with Keith Carradine and Harvey Keitel. That's 10 times the movie Napoleon is. And the other, you know, Napoleon commits the crime of being extremely boring as well. It's a bit up its own arse. It's a bit, it loves itself a bit too much. It's almost a bit like, I'm Ridley Scott.
You're not.
You know, I can do no wrong. Well, that's not true. And I think the very fact, I mean, I'm not an awards season person. I don't give a fuck. But I think it's very telling that that's not high on anyone's list of likelihood of winning.
It hasn't
been
on anyone's radar, it feels like.
No.
This is certified horseshit.
Now, if you're just making a movie like Mel Gibson made with Apocalypto, it's about a time in history. You can play around with that. When you're dealing with a genuine historical figure, if you're going to start fucking around, why make it about that person if you're going to start making shit up? So fuck this movie, basically. Mobland should be the piece of shit movie this month.
Fair point.
And Napoleon should be the winner. And the fact that that's completely not the case says it all, really, about the state of Hollywood and the state of where money is being spent.
So, we are here for our Scott Brother Smackdown between Tony, the late great Tony, and the very old and now curmudgeonly possibly Ridley that we just bashed on a few minutes ago.
And now the moment you've all been waiting for, our Scott Family Showdown main event. In the red corner is Tony Scott's 1991 action comedy, The Last Boy Scout. And in the blue corner is Ridley Scott's 1989 neo-noir crime thriller, Black Rain. So get ready for a no-holds-barred head-to-head collision of two Scott Brothers action movie stalwarts. Two movies enter, only one movie leaves. It's time for the Men of Action's movie face-off.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Now, before we get into the films, let's just talk about where they were when these two movies came out. The Last Boy Scout from Tony Scott came out in 1991. Prior to that was Days of Thunder, a very successful movie that came out in 1990. And post this film, one of my favorite and favorite Tony Scott film, True Romance from 1993. And then Mr. Ridley Scott's Black Rain came out in 1989. Prior to this, he had Someone to Watch Over Me in 1987. But again, as some say, he had a little bit of a career dip, and then this movie in 1991 was definitely cemented him as being back in the game with Thelma and Louise in 1991. And the interesting part of that is a young Brad Pitt gets a bit of a role and was so good in that one, got a little extra role in his brother's movie 2 years later when he did True Romance. So the Scott brothers shared a little Brad Pitt menage a trois.
This is true.
And that's the most French you've heard. And I'm not even a Napoleon. So bam, I already have more French than Napoleon does. Now, let's talk about both of them before we get into the films, because I think the common person who is a film fan would probably say that the better of the brothers, or the more renowned of the brothers, would be Ridley. However, in doing the little preparation for this episode, I don't know if that's true or not. Like, let's start with Ridley. We'll just go through a little of his good movies he's done. All right, as you were saying, one of his first, The Duelists. Then, now look, he comes out with two genre-defining films in a row. It's going to be hard to beat, I'll be honest. Alien and Blade Runner. He could have bowed out that day and he was walking off into the sunset. Although, I think his follow-up to Blade Runner is a movie that I thoroughly enjoy and is a great fantasy movie. That's Legend, which stars a very young Tom Cruise. I've always kind of liked that movie.
I saw Legend at the cinema. I was there, yeah.
I think it's a very underrated film of Mr. Ridley's.
Yeah, that's like a cult movie. That's considered a cult movie now.
Then the movie we're going to talk about today, Black Rain. Thelma and Louise, of course, is big. And then, I mean, really, he's got a couple that come out. G.I. Jane, yeah, nothing spectacular. Like, between Thelma and Louise and then 2000's Gladiator, where he once again, I mean, he comes back in and reintroduces the epic. Prior to this, I think the epic was like Mel Gibson said, hey, here's Braveheart. And I was like, oof, that's the one. But Gladiator is one of those ones that can stand toe to toe with Braveheart, and you go, Jesus, these are both amazing.
I think it treads all over Braveheart.
Oh, okay. Ooh, that might be. Ooh, I hear season three duel. There's a season three.
No, I know. Everyone knows I'm a massive.
He's a card carrying member of the Mel Gibson fan club, and he's just lost that membership right here on this program.
You got that right. You've got that right.
He then does Hannibal and Black Hawk Down, and a very underrated movie too, Matchstick Men, with a spectacular Nicolas Cage performance.
Very good movie.
And then after that, you know, American Gangster is pretty good. Body of Lies is a spectacular film with Leonardo DiCaprio. I actually enjoyed Prometheus. The Counselor's not bad. The Martian, it was okay. Alien Covenant, not bad.
See, we could do it.
Not bad. Like, the last duel was much better. House of Gucci and Napoleon. So decent films there. But his brother has a shorter time. Unfortunately, his last film was in 2010, and his first is in 1983. So he gets just barely 20 years of film in there. A little over 20. His first was The Hunger. Not bad. Some might say his next two were comparable. Now, they're not going to be in the same guard for some people as Alien and Blade Runner, but Top Gun and Beverly Hills Cop 2 sure as fuck lit up the summer screens in the mid-80s for sure.
No question.
Then he does Revenge. Not bad. I mean, it's a good Kevin Costner movie, but you know, it's...
That's got a bit of a reputation, yeah. Though, but I watched that quite recently. That's shaky. That's shady. Not sure about that one.
Days of Thunder. Another huge movie for him. That was a spectacular movie. I mean, even like NASCAR, it was a fun movie. Then we get The Last Boy Scout. Then he does True Romance, Crimson Tide, Fan, Enemy of the State, okay, Spy Game. Love that movie. Such a good movie with Brad Pitt and Robert Redford. Man on Fucking Fire. Domino's not bad. Deja Vu. I kind of like that one.
Underrated.
The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3. Now listen, I like the original better.
Of course.
However, I saw that one first and then the other one, though. So I saw it in reverse, and it's okay.
There's worse remakes. True. There's worse remakes than that.
And his final film, Unstoppable, was actually, I was pretty enjoyable. It wasn't terrible. Like, I didn't hate it. Maybe because Denzel's in it and Chris Pine, and they both are really good acting together. I mean, yeah, it's a train going off the rails thing. But apparently, at the end, he wanted to do two train movies. He was really big on train movies.
Pretty decent.
So, but he has some pretty decent fucking credits to himself, too, right?
So, definitely.
So I think he needs a little bit more appraisal. I don't think he's as bad as everyone thinks he is, or as underrated as he should be.
Yeah.
Now let's dive into him, because our first film comes to us from Mr. Smith this month. He has chosen, on his side of the fight, he's going with Tony Scott in the 1991 action comedy, The Last Boy Scout.
It's time for the tale of the tape. The Last Boy Scout was written by Shane Black and directed by Tony Scott, starring Bruce Willis, Damon Wayans, Halle Berry, Chelsea Field, Noble Willingham, Tyler Negron, Daniel Harris, Bruce McGill, Chelsea Ross, and Billy Blanks. made on a budget of $43 million and grossing $114.5 million at the box office. It holds a 7 rating on IMDb and a 46 critic and 68 audience score on Rotten Tomatoes. On Letterboxd, Steve gave it 3 stars, while Scott gave it 2.5 stars. A private detective's protected female witness is murdered, prompting him and the victim's boyfriend to investigate the crime that leads to a corrupt politician and crooked football team owner in Warner Brothers' The Last Boy Scout.
This ain't no game, Flash.
Joe Hallenbeck's a private detective who's run out of luck.
If you touch me again, I'll kill you.
Two for two.
Told you.
Jimmy Dix.
I like bricks.
Is an ex-quarterback who was thrown out of football.
Another tragic tale of wasted youth.
You're nobody.
Shh. Don't tell anyone.
They were trying to clean up their acts.
You vacuum, I'll dust.
When they got dragged into the dirty world of sports corruption.
So you're gonna bribe some senators to legalize gambling?
Legalize sports gambling. Now.
Son, we're going to a ball game.
Got one shot.
What am I gonna do? Point at the bad guys and shoot!
To get the goods. Ah! On the bad guys.
Just once, I would like to hear you scream.
Play some rap music.
It's out of ideas, man. Take your best shot.
If they don't kill each other first.
That was a bomb?
That had a hell of a factory recall.
Bruce Willis, Damon Wayans, The Last Boy Scout.
Danger's my middle name.
Mine's Cornelius. Don't tell anybody I kill you.
Mr. Smith, what do you have for us as far as trivia, behind the scenes, and odds and ends that the listeners should know about The Last Boy Scout before we discuss this phenomenal film? Oh, no matter what we say about these films, we actually enjoy them. But I do feel we have to bring to light its goods and its bads. And that's just the
Absolutely.
Fairness of reappraisal movies. But don't get,
Absolutely.
This is not a shit recommendation. We enjoy these films. We didn't pick these films to go, fuck this film, fuck your film, fuck Cardi's film.
Bottom line is, actually, I don't give a fuck which movie wins this, really. Put it that way.
Okay.
But anyway, there's a lot
let's
to unpack.
Let's go.
Here,
Last
actually.
Boy Scout, let's unpack this bitch.
So, Last Boy Scout, 1991, by Mr. Tony Scott. With a budget of $43 million, box office $115 million. Not a failure, not a massive success. But at this point, Bruce Willis was on shaky ground after making Die Hard. He then made Hudson Hawk, which, as you know, a big fan. But yeah, he was kind of, you know, he'd started off on a high. Next movie, he got his ass handed to him and said, sit back down, you're not there yet. But Roger Ebert gave this movie 3 stars out of 4.
He sure did. May he rest in peace.
Saying it was, he said, it was a superb example of what it is. A glossy, skillful, cynical, smart, utterly corrupt, and vilely misogynistic action thriller, which...
That should be in the box. That should be in the box.
Thumbs up from me. Desson Howe of the Washington Post, he called it the filmic equivalent of a hate crime. It's mindless anti-civilization formula for boys who can't get enough. Now, the film was based on an original script by Mr. Shane Black, who wrote the script after taking a 2-year break from writing, triggered in part by the end of a relationship. And the Geffen Company outbid other companies, paying a record $1.75 million for the script. So Shane Black is quoted as saying, I was busy mourning my life and in many ways the loss of my first real love. I didn't feel much like doing anything except smoking cigarettes and reading paperbacks. Eventually, I sat down and transformed some of that bitterness into a character, the central focus of a private eye story, which became The Last Boy Scout. Writing the script was a very cathartic experience, one of the best experiences I've ever had. It was a wonderfully intense time when my focus was better than it's ever been. I was rewarded handsomely for that script. It felt like a vindication and like I was back on track. Now, Joel Silver was the producer, and he was guaranteed $1 million to produce the movie. And according to Joel Silver, Shane Black's original title, The Last Boy Scout, was Die Hard. Silver asked if he could take the title for another project he was working on at the time called Nothing Lasts Forever, which eventually became 1988's Die Hard. So we've got, you know, we're in the Bruce mm-hmm. world here. Now, much like Red Heat from last time, this movie had a very troubled production. Everyone was swinging their dick around on this, apparently. You know, you had conflict and arguments between Joel Silver, Bruce Willis, and Tony Scott. And although they partner up in the film, Willis and Damon Wayans apparently hated working with each other. And Joel Silver was described as insane with long, horrible fits of sanity, which I'm not sure if that's true, that that's a true quote, because I think that's an Edgar Allan Poe quote. Well. So I don't know. But anyway, the on-set tension was attributed to an abundance of alpha males on the project. Bruce Willis was at the height of his stardom, as were Joel Silver, Tony Scott, and Shane Black. According to assistant director James Scotch DePaul, there were a lot of people who had a lot of opinions about what to do. There were some heated early 90s testosterone-charged personalities on the line. It was a charged environment. Writer Shane Black had to wrestle with the script. He was forced to rewrite a lot of it. Well, he was rewriting it. At least he wasn't writing it as the film went along, like Red Heat. And there was tremendous pressure from the studio to get Bruce Willis and have a follow-up to Die Hard. He was reluctant, and rightly so. The whole movie is about me saving my wife. I just did that in Die Hard. So they minimized the wife.
Big time. I forgot how much she's not in the film.
Yeah. And while we're at it, the big finale, you know, at the stadium with the helicopter, was written in because it didn't have the big ending that they needed because of Die Hard. Shane Black and Tony Scott both expressed dissatisfaction with the final film and said in later years how the original script was far better. Scott accused Joel Silver of interfering with the production and swore off working with the producer ever again. And in his next film, True Romance, he features an unflattering film producer named Lee Donowitz, who was patterned after Joel Silver. So that's where we are. This is Testosterone City. Everyone's waving their dick around saying, this is my movie. And we get a kind of mishmash of all the tropes. The wonderful tropes, or the good, the bad, and the ugly yes. tropes that you get with a buddy movie. It's uneven, but it's heavy on the action. And there must be a million one-liners in this movie.
Almost all delivered by Bruce.
Literally everything Bruce Willis says in this movie is a one-liner.
Yeah.
Damon Wayans gives him a run for his money as well. He's got some good shit in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of them films, I think, for all the punches, kicks, explosions, car chases, it's very average. And let's not forget the amazing theme song sung by Bill Everly of the Righteous Brothers. Friday night's a great night for football. Yeah.
That was my first thing. It is such a Monday Night Football wannabe, but they can't take Monday Night Football.
I mean, I wouldn't know. I mean, that's lost
yeah,
on
so
me.
So Monday Night Football
fair.
Has its but own song by Hank Williams Jr. It used to be like, all my rowdy friends are here on Monday Night. It's this really hillbilly, drunken song that all Americans pumped up for football. Punch my wife, let's go. You know what I mean? So the fact that they picked Friday, I was like, okay. And it's totally 90s vibe too.
Absolutely. But also, I'll give this movie a lot of credit in a lot of ways, but it still falls short. The opening with Billy Blanks blowing his brains out on the football field after shooting a bunch of football players is amazing.
Yes.
I mean, it's completely over the top.
Yeah, like it makes no sense.
Well, yeah, but we're talking about a buddy fucking. We're talking about a private detective teaming up with a disgraced football player to solve crime.
Thank you. Please, I don't want to be the guy to point. I want you to point on your own film. I don't want to be like, you realize this is one of the dumb, like, there's no reason for Damon Wayans to be in this movie.
That's why I like it. That is ridiculous. But, so that's the kind of movie we're dealing with here. So if you want to start bringing, don't be bringing reality into this, because we are in a totally singular, bizarre world here.
Yes. I love Bruce in this film. He is...
It is self-loathing best.
I mean, he is the total anti... It's almost... You know what I was thinking about today? He's the anti-John McClane. But I feel like what he tapped into in this film is the John McClane he becomes in Vengeance, in number three, right? Like, he's a completely cynical, down his luck. Him and Holly are no longer together. He's not saving that bitch for a third time. You know what I mean? Like, who he is in this film, he kind of really then re-embraces and becomes John McClane when we get to Die Hard with a Vengeance. Spectacular
Agreed.
Sequel.
Agreed.
And every moment he is on screen is enjoyable.
And he's on the screen a lot.
Thankful. And, you know, it's fun because we've been on, you know, the journey we've been on. So it was nice to watch.
Well, yeah, that's a whole another story.
And you know what it did? Good or bad? Maybe bad. Because, like, so I saw Die Hard at Christmas because I'm an American and that's what Jesus wanted. All right. You see Die Hard on Christmas Eve. That's what I watched. And so, again, I know that movie like forwards and backwards. But to see him in a different movie and see how good he is, and then now with the journey we're on, and you kind of go, you do see how much. Whether it's the aphasia or age or just not caring anymore, like how much he's kind of crept back from how good an actor he was. Because he is spectacular in this. And listen, I'm not taking anything away from Damon Wayans, because Damon Wayans is a part of a truly amazing family and was a part of a comedic revolution that almost took down Saturday Night Live. I know you don't have that over. We are. But with a living color. And I mean, they introduced Jamie Foxx and Jim Carrey.
Which jumpstarted Jim Carrey.
Jamie Foxx. Yeah. He jumpstarted all their careers. It was a spectacular variety show. They were amazing on it. I don't know that Damon is that good in this film. I think he is miscast. And I think he's a poor man's Eddie Murphy. And my one downfall, now rewatching this, is obviously Shane Black. So if anyone doesn't know, Shane Black also wrote Lethal Weapon. It felt like we're going to do a little bit of a Lethal Weapon retread, but maybe a little bit more down and not a crazy Murdoch, but a different one. And I just feel like I have no qualms with Bruce Willis. Like, Bruce Willis is so good. Well, no, I was like, this is why I'm enjoying this film.
He carries it. Like, yeah, I get that.
Damon Wayans didn't show up as much as he did with Bruce, because I was like...
But that's kind of in retrospect, because at the time...
True, no, at the time we didn't know. You know, at the time it was like two big stars.
We didn't know. But what I was going to say was every buddy cop movie... is they're all riffing on Lethal Weapon, which was riffing on 48 Hours. I've read interviews with Shane Black where he says when he saw 48 Hours, that was the final jigsaw piece for him to start his writing career the way it went. So, like I said, you know, this is a film, I like this movie.
It has some of the greatest, like, mini scene, like moments, like the closet scene, which I'm thinking of probably 1,000 people. Probably it's almost like sometimes I talk about Mandy, the Nicolas Cage movie, where everyone sees him freaking out in the bathroom. They have no idea why. It's that closet scene. No one has any idea what happens in the movie prior or after this, but they all know the who's in the fucking closet. You know what I mean? And he's going to shoot the closet door. It's a great fucking moment. Spectacular.
Me and my friend who I work with, we do the head or gut scene all the time.
Head or gut, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, when one of us fucks up.
Head or gut.
That's like the other one says head or gut. It's one of them, I'm put it this way. That's like, I'm very fond of this movie.
No, I know why. There's a nostalgia.
Yeah, warts and all, as we say. Like, yeah, it's not going to win any fucking awards. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a Lethal Weapon, but it's not Tango and Cash either.
No.
So it's kind of nestled in the middle there.
Dare you besmirch Tango and Cash? I know what you mean. Yeah.
I've got it up on my shelf, okay? Don't get me wrong.
What it does is it shows that how much movies have changed, though, in the 30 years that we've been watching, right? Like, it's crazy, because back then, I remember that. I mean, it was a big movie. This Damon Wayans was big. Bruce Willis is huge. So everyone's going to go see this movie. We all go see this movie.
If I could just say, though, from a British perspective, we didn't know who Damon Wayans was.
Fair.
So you've got the kind of, you've got American football, you've got Damon Wayans, and British people didn't know much about either. And I'm sure there's more sort of sporty types in the UK did, but I'm not a sport fan. So American football to me, it's all Greek to me. Can I still say that? Not get cancelled? I don't know.
If a person wants to cancel you, has any idea if that's even racist? Not. But if they... by Greek means it's all the hieroglyphics. You don't know what they mean. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. You know. But yeah, so American football was lost on me. I didn't know Damon Wayans was. We didn't have Living Colour on our TV sets. So as far as we were probably concerned, this is such a quip-heavy one-liner movie. Yeah. Damon Wayans gets his moments... and I felt, anyway, that he delivered them well enough. But at the same time, for me, I just think of this as a Bruce Willis movie.
Me too.
No one's thinking of this as a Damon Wayans movie.
Which is
movie.
Probably why he didn't really move on to do any, like, his movies afterwards.
He didn't. He did his own,
comedic stuff, which is where he excels.
Put it this way. I don't think of 48 Hours as a Nick Nolte movie.
I don't think Nick Nolte does either.
He probably can't remember making it at this point. But if you've seen his mugshot, I'm not sure he remembers anything. But you think of 48 Hours as an Eddie Murphy movie, but you don't think of Last Boy Scout as a Damon Wayans movie. So I agree with you when you say miscast.
And it's in retrospect. When I went to see the movie, I didn't think that way.
Yeah.
But I felt something was off.
You didn't.
Remember seeing it.
But you're going to watch a movie more than once. That's just the nature of things. So over time, you start to think, well, you know what? If Eddie Murphy would have been that fucking football player, we'd all be jerking off right now. So it's only a minor issue to me because Bruce Willis is in literally every shot of the movie.
And his standalone, like the moments he's by himself, are even more spectacular.
Oh, I love him in this. I love him in this.
One of the problems the movie has is it doesn't have a good villain. The Milo guy is absolutely fucking useless.
He's creepy, though.
He is creepy. He doesn't make anybody tremble with fear. Like, we're supposed to be like, oh, no, Milo's here. You know,
although I did kind of like it.
No one's, like, worried about Milo the henchman.
I did kind of like it when Bruce Willis says to him, I guess you're the bad guy. And he says, I am the bad guy. I did kind of like it.
It was okay. I
know what you're saying. I know what you're saying.
The scene where he gets the cigarette in the pool area. And he said, you touch me again, I'm going to fucking kill you. And he does. And that's the other side of the scene. Those two scenes alone are worth the movie, watching the movie, because they're...
Absolutely.
They're classic Bruce Willis fucking moments. Like,
there's so many of them.
I think even as a fan of Bruce Willis, you think so much of him in Die Hard. Rightfully so. Very few actors have come onto the scene in their first real starring role in a movie and have taken it over like he did in Die Hard. I mean, he became John McClane in that moment. And so you remember all his yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, and all the little things, you know what I mean? Take this under advisement, all these little things he did in those movies, but you forget about the, you touch him again, and then he puts his fucking nose to his head.
You know,
you're just like, whoa.
Water's wet, the sky's blue, women have secrets, you know, there's a million of them, you know, and put it this way, but this movie, if above all else, this movie puts Bruce Willis back on the map.
Oh, 100%. 100%. This movie, because I think also this year, he also put out, I think Die Hard 2 came out that same year, I think 1990.
Which, come on. Die Hard 2 is the fucking shit. I love Die Hard 2.
I love Die Hard 2.
I love the first three. I like Die Hard 2 more than I like the third one.
Oh, that's fair.
But that's not what we're talking about.
But the third one is very good, too. And after the third one, they could have shut it down. They could have shut down Die Hard.
If I'm drunk enough, I'll watch the fourth one. But that's a whole nother story. But anyway,
and if you're being forcibly possibly raped by you may be raped by a guy named
I'll
Zed.
Watch the
Zed.
But anyway, so you know, above all else, that's my bit. That's what I'm saying about this movie. It puts Bruce Willis back on the map. It doesn't reinvent the wheel. He hasn't got the right co-star, and there is no villain.
No, not for this
and
one,
that's what stops this movie from being a four possibly 5 out of 5 movies.
I agree with you.
But fortunately, you've got Tony Scott and Joel Silver. So Joel Silver knows how to spend the money.
Fair.
And Tony
Scott...
He may
be an idiot, but yeah.
Yeah, and Tony Scott, no one does action like Tony Scott. He's got his own unique way of doing it.
And you could see, when I was watching, I could see, because I know this is, the next movie is True Romance. And you can see some things he's going to take with him into True Romance.
Definitely.
Because we get... people on fire firing shotguns. That was the first time, because when they're in that little room, I was like, that's coming back. Even the driving the big car. They drive the big car. And that there's some key moments in that film. You can see where it kind of he held on to some of these ideas and he put them into True Romance, which only helped to enhance the story. But you can see the difference though when you get good co-stars who work better who are right in the movie and the right villains. And that's why True Romance jumps way ahead of it. Because probably there wasn't the interference. And that's another problem with Joel Silver. He may spend the money, but when you put your fingers in the pie,
he fucks around. And also, apparently, Last Boy Scout was heavily censored before release as well because of the violence. So ultimately, that's where I fall on the movie is like, it's not the best, but it's got its pluses. There's more pluses than minuses. I say the movie's got enough in its favor to elevate it, but not enough to make it above average.
Yeah, if you want to just see some key moments, If you want to see a Bruce Willis movie that's not a Die Hard film, if you want to remember what Bruce was like in his action days, this is a great moment to see. He's great. I don't like the jig at the end thing. That was fucking stupid, but whatever.
I liked it.
But everything else, though, the "you touch me, gonna fucking kill you." Choice moments, choice lines. He's spectacular. He delivers an amazing performance. And the only, for me, the only drawback besides them monkeying around with everything, which is not the creator's fault, with the producers are fucking everything up. You can only do what you can do.
Exactly.
Just Damon Wayans now in 30 years in retrospect, now in, as we've rewatched it, he now sticks out like a sore thumb to me, where he might not have back in the early 90s when I was younger and he was big and popular.
But where we differ, and I think we might always differ, is
yeah.
You're wrong. No, where we differ, is in the context of his time, that wasn't an issue. So I don't pick holes in that.
But if you haven't seen the film, or you haven't seen it in a while, it will be one of the things that will now stick out. In a reappraisal, rewatching of the film, you might go, okay, yeah, this, I didn't notice this back in the 90s when I was watching.
Well, not me. But also, as we pointed out, we didn't know who Damon Wayans was over here. So we're culturally seeing it different ways. Mm-hmm. You're saying that worked in Living Colour, but it doesn't work here. We've got no comparison. Yeah. So we're with it. We're just there with it. And that's what you've got. So that's just a difference in cultural kind of goings on.
Yeah, that's when you're not the greatest country in the world and like we are, and you're, you know, the second fiddle. It's fine. It happens.
We're a very small country, do you know what I mean? We barely have a film industry, so come on. But yeah, so,
which is weird because you used to own everything, but now
economics, man. You know, we have to sell shit off.
We can't, everything's got to go. We can't afford
yard sale, you know. You went cheap.
So many people who are maybe listeners of those countries who used to run, they're probably not feeling the same way as we just lightly take away of imperialism.
Everything was better when we owned it, and you know it. Anyway, so yeah, there you go.
It's time for the tale of the tape. Black Rain was written by Craig Bolton and Warren Lewis, directed by Ridley Scott, starring Michael Douglas, Andy Garcia, Ken Takakura, Kate Capshaw, Yusaku Matsuda, Shigeru Koyama, Tomasiburo Wakayama, and John Spencer. Made on a budget of $30 million and grossing $134.2 million at the box office. It holds a 6.6 rating on IMDb, with a 54 critics and 55 audience score on Rotten Tomatoes. On Letterboxd, Steve gives us 3 stars, while Scott gave it 4 stars. Two New York cops get involved in a gang war between members of the Yakuza when they arrest a high-level member and are forced to escort him back to Japan. In Paramount Pictures, Black Rain.
A New York City cop.
Look out!
On the trail of a killer. From the back alleys of Manhattan.
Well, our victims are certainly Yakuza.
To the streets of Japan.
Because of your negligence, a man we've wanted for a long time has been lost.
Now come on, we'll take some of the heat for this, but we're not taking the rap.
Rap?
You see, there's a war going on here between Sato and an old-time boss named Sugai. And they don't take prisoners.
So where's your boss?
This isn't New York. We have rules here.
I've seen Sato's work, okay? He ain't following your program.
You are foreigners. Nothing more than interested observers.
No one's gonna help a Kaijin.
Kaijin?
You're a barbarian, a foreigner. Me and you. More you.
Try to work like a Japanese.
Now, this is good. This ain't money. You got a counterfeiting war going on, guys.
You are civilians here. It is illegal for you to carry a gun.
Something tells me we should cut our losses and let the locals handle it around here.
I can't go back without him, Charlie.
You have no part in this.
I am the solution to your problems. Well, it's not over yet.
Here I am, Nick!
You can get him, boss. You and me.
Michael Douglas, Black Rain.
All right. Our second film, as you just heard, is Mr. Ridley Scott's 1989 action thriller, Black Rain. And I've got a little lowdown on some things that happened. Not as crazy as what happened in fucking The Last Boy Scout, I can tell you that. So while this is not as juicy as The Last Boy Scout, but here what we got. This is Yusaku Matsuda's last film role. He died of bladder cancer 7 weeks after the film's debut. Yusaku is Sato, the villain in this film. He filmed this with the cancer, knew he would eventually die from it, but did not inform Ridley Scott or the producers, which makes him even more of a badass than he was in the fucking film, in my opinion.
Yeah, damn right.
Now, the film's climactic winery shootout was shot in Napa County, California, not in Japan. So, suck it, Japan. That kind of disappointed me a little. I'm not going to lie, because I saw that and
surprising.
I was like, I want to take a trip to Japan and I want to find this little fucking place. And then I was like, nope, I can just go to the West Coast and it'll be out there. It's like, I was like,
that's pretty crazy.
It's disappointing. Now, this is kind of a synergetic thing. We kind of had some diehard name change from The Last Boy Scout, and it's a Tony Scott film, and Tony Scott is known for Beverly Hills Cop 2. This is the plot that was originally supposed to be the plot of Beverly Hills Cop 2, believe it or not.
Really?
Black Rain, yes. So clearly the tone of the film was definitely changed and toned down, and things definitely changed, because you see Beverly Hills Cop 2, and you see this film, you go, it may be a buddy cop type movie because there's a buddy in it. Like, he's got a partner. Well, this is not a buddy cop movie. You know what I mean? Having a partner and being a buddy are two different things. I was thinking, that's quite a rewrite, though. That's quite an impressive rewrite to take the tone of this and change it. Just like those who don't know, The Rock. If you listen to our Bayhem, how can you miss that 3-month epic? But The Rock was originally the script and plot for Die Hard 2. Mm. So things change. Change in the movie business. Michael Douglas has named this as one of his favorite films from his illustrious career. Pretty high marks.
I can see why.
But yeah, I don't know how long he said it, but
I mean,
he's been in some pretty decent films. So for him to name this, that's pretty impressive. Those of you who have a good eye will notice that Sugai's house, the leader of the Japanese mafia, the older gentleman, was used by Ridley in Blade Runner as Decker's apartment complex.
Wow.
Wow. So a couple hundred years later, it becomes an apartment complex. It's not so fancy anymore. It ends up a shithole. So this really nice place. Now, a fun bit of info is while in the film, Nick is made a laughingstock for signing his prisoner over on insurance forms. Had the events been real, it would have paled in comparison to the lapse of Japanese police in not securing the plane at the airport before the mob could board. Conklin could have also sued in international court and would have been under no obligation to track down the suspect, having successfully extradited him. Just, I love those little tidbits from someone who's got like a law degree is like, hey, dear IMDb,
actually,
let me explain something to you. Yeah, actually, fuck faces. How dare you ever. Now, there is an alternate ending that Ridley shot where Nick does impale Sato on the spike at the end. However, I have never seen a director's cut version where the movie ends that way, which would then change things. I don't know how they would end it differently. I mean, I guess it could be the same. He just, instead of them walking him in,
carries him in.
They drop off the plates. Yeah, exactly. I don't know how else they do it. So I've never seen it. So if it's out there, I would love to see it. But those are my small little tidbits about this film. And I will go right out and say that this was one of my favorite films of the early 90s when I was still young. Like this is one of those first films I really was like, oh, I really like this. And I started to realize that as I was growing up, as I was becoming a teenager, I was in my teenage years, that my taste of like the action hero films were starting to change. I was starting to move more towards these gritty crime dramas, which would totally explain why I like True Romance.
Which definitely is.
Black Rain is a perfect example of that. Yeah, it was like the start of that. And I noticed that was my shift, which is why probably, I don't want to say that Black Rain is the tip of the spear, but it's one of the movies that first really introduced me.
No, but it made a big impact on you, you know?
Yeah, man. And that's early 80s. So I started to notice that I was starting to slide a little bit more towards like, oh, I really kind of like these grittier dramas as opposed to like the, don't get me wrong, I still
fucking love
Predator.
I know what you're saying. I'm with you.
Started to realize that my taste was starting to mature a bit.
Yeah.
And would explain why most of the movies I enjoy are I will go see a crime drama or a crime thriller before I see anything else. You know, that'd be like one of the first things I will go see. Some people love romantic comedies. For me, that's not for me. I like there to be stakes. I like there to be something in it. Yeah. So this is one of those ones. But we talk about opening theme songs. 80s gentlemen.
Yeah.
This is a total 80s opening sequence. The funny thing is like the rest of the movie doesn't really feel 80s, but this moment 100% does. It's that we got our hero, we're singing some kind of weird ballad about how he's maybe a loner and he's on the loose.
Michael Bolton style, like power ballad.
Yeah, he's like riding through New York City on a motorcycle and you're like,
I'm a badass.
Like,
yeah. Suck my dick, motherfuckers. Like,
exactly. I ride motorcycles and I fuck ladies in the men's room.
Woo. But I'm a sensitive guy.
Because my first girlfriend died in a tragic boating accident. It's just kind of like, and I've got a mullet.
Oh, yeah.
It's just kind of like, what? Even the visuals don't necessarily hold what he's saying. The kind of like, so he's going to like an illegal bike race or something like that. You're kind of like, wait a minute, what's happening? So it was the most 80s moment in that. And then I started to think, like, Michael Douglas is also one of those anti kind of action heroes like Bruce Willis would end up, because this came out the same year as Die Hard. Obviously, Die Hard would probably.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
that's true.
But
yeah.
They're both anti.
But we're getting away from that muscle man thing, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah, we are. We are. We're starting to get to like more of a. We're starting to lead towards that cop who does things, maybe walks the line between criminality, but gets the job done type guy.
Yeah, we like them guys.
We like to know that, hey, yeah, I stole $20 out of the register, but damn it, I'm the best customer service guy.
That never worked for me. But yeah, you know, I'll say Michael Douglas, he's a strange one, really, isn't he? Because, I mean, obviously, he was a producer. He got One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest made. He was a mover and a shaker.
Well, having your father be Kurt Douglas, one of the original people in Hollywood with royalty. Like, I mean, it does help to have your dad as being Kurt Douglas. I mean, although Michael has stood on his own.
Yeah, that's where I was going. That's what I was going to say.
But I'm saying, like, but even,
okay,
you know, I mean,
maybe,
was,
but he
yeah.
got, like, you know, above all else.
Agreed.
You know,
but like saying, but, you know, yeah. I mean, some people do get a little bit of a hand up. You
Fair
know?
Enough.
It's like the Kardashians saying, like, oh, we did it all on our own. Mm-hmm. Nah, your dad
he didn't
got
do anything.
OJ Simpson off, and then you took some cum on the back, and let yeah. me know, that's but,
you know, but
that's
he,
put a pause
you know,
in it.
Producer, you know, mover and a shaker, behind the scenes guy, but he's got incredible presence
he
and
does,
charisma.
Incredible.
Especially in this. Because I'll be honest with you, I can't say I'm a big fan of his.
Really? Okay. Wall Street, no? The Game from Fincher?
Fincher.
I don't know.
You always do that.
I always put the actor's name.
I know. William Fincher.
I don't know why I do that.
I even.
And I appreciate you letting me slide for like 18 episodes.
I know. I just keep.
He's like, every time you listen to the episode,
I'm always
like,
I'm not going to tell him if he don't fucking. Anyway, listen.
I know too.
Fucking, that's why I don't bother.
Fucking asshole. What an asshole.
Schmuck.
We're shutting it down.
You don't really like movies, do you? So, no.
We won't be having Fincher on our show ever now.
Oh,
he was all set up, too.
No wonder he's making movies for Netflix now. He's done with Hollywood. That's all your fault. I'm not saying there's not films that I like with him in it, but he's just not someone I'm particularly into. You know, this movie, you know, he's so good in this movie. And I really, one of the things I really like about this movie is he is a corrupt cop, and that's just the way it is. I mean, obviously, he proves himself ultimately that he's not in his own way,
mm-hmm.
but he is, and he admits to it, and he comes clean, and he's just unapologetic about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that about it. And I do really like, as you pointed out earlier, when he doesn't throw the bad guy onto that spike. I like how that was handled because it cuts away,
mm-hmm.
doesn't
agreed.
It?
Agreed.
Because
mm-hmm.
I couldn't, because when I watched
know.
It this time, I couldn't remember. I thought, if that bad guy falls on that spike, I'm going to be super fucking pissed. You know, so he dies, but he didn't do it. If they were going to pull that, that was really going to piss me off. But it cuts away and it just shows him bringing him in. And I was like, that's badass. That's more badass than killing
mm-hmm.
it. So, you know, there's that. I've got issues. Andy Garcia being a big one.
Really? Because I thought Andy Garcia was really good in this.
Again.
Because he's playing a 28-year-old, brash, flashy cop, right? Still shiny, still a little wet behind the ears. So I really liked Andy Garcia because
I think that's a bit hammed up.
Okay,
and
that's
the
fair.
Bit,
and
that's
the
fair. Bit where he gets his head cut off. Obviously, I love that.
You didn't like that?
No, I do. Okay. I don't. I like people getting beheaded in films, obviously, because I'm a psychopath. But I just don't like the way that was handled with Michael Douglas just basically standing behind and fucking stood there. I'm a little bit like, it has to happen. That scene has to happen. So I'm not like, don't get it.
But yeah, but it does feel like, how did he not be able
Come
to get
on,
back
man.
There?
He
yeah.
fucking,
I know what you mean.
It, you know, you're the expert, man. Your yeah. rookie partner's in the shit. And you just stand yeah. there. I always had a, but I had a problem with that always, even when I was a kid and I watched it. But I mean, I do like Andy Garcia. I don't know, just something. It's just a bit. I think that's just a bit overplayed in this movie. But I think he's Damon Wayans.
Yes, I was gonna say he's your Damon Wayans for this. For me, I'm like, I don't mind it. And you loved it. I was like, Damon Wayans, fucking, he's a fish out of water in this film.
Because I'm like, Michael Douglas is just firing on all cylinders.
I was thinking about this. He and Bruce Willis have some great choice lines in their movies. Like, and just the way they deliver them, like,
do you know what?
They found a way to make great one-liners while doing something. So, like, when he stretches and hits him in the jaw, and he's like, what do you do? He goes, I think he bit his lip or something. And he's fucking still counting cards. Or I usually get kissed before I get fucked. I've used that line 100 times.
So have I. That's where I was then going. I have been saying it all my life, and I never knew where I'd got it from. And the other one is fuck you very much.
Yes.
And I never... And it wasn't until this rewatch.
He and Bruce, in that year, they changed the one-liners and, you know, give credit to these directors.
They made him a bit more sadistic and sinister.
Exactly. Yeah. And they made him feel sarcastic and almost like being said as like a fuck you without saying fuck you to somebody. Like you know, I don't know, just had a really good feel to
and
it.
And another good thing I like about Douglas in this is the end fight, the punch-up he has with the bad guy. He gets his ass handed to him pretty much.
Quite a bit,
I'm always a fan of that.
Yeah. How about the opening gangster scene, too? Because in the 80s, this would have been like a whole different awful shootout where they really played it to cut the throat and then they chase him. Like, it really is more realistic. It felt real. I mean, like you said, he got the jump on him again. He was being fucking asphyxiated with the bag on his head until Andy shows up and saves his ass. Like,
yeah, the Japanese cop that he teams up with, Masahiro.
Ken Takakura.
He's actually from a film called Yakuza. I don't know if you've ever seen Yakuza.
Yeah, and they were saying that he usually plays the bad guy, and the guy who plays Sato, who ended up passing away, he usually plays the cops in their films.
Well, Yakuza was written by Paul Schrader and directed by Sidney Pollack. That's a Robert Mitchum movie, but that got changed a lot from Paul Schrader's script as well, apparently. But that's where I kind of knew him from. But yeah, so this movie is not an action movie. This is a gritty cop thriller. And Douglas is on fire.
And the pacing's pretty good. And it's a good telling of the story. Like, we take time to get to place. Like, we don't rush in normal action movies, especially in the 80s. We don't just rush through to get to our ending. Like, they try to tell a story as opposed to being like, okay, we're just going to jump from action to action to action, which is what I felt. Unfortunately, probably what happened to our Blast Boy Scout movie, where that's where you see the meddling. Well, they didn't meddle with this, and they allowed a story to be a little bit longer and told, even though it's still only a two-hour movie.
Yeah, I mean, I'll push back a little bit. I was a bit bored with it at certain points, personally. But it's because I'm trying to compare two movies here, and I'm like, there's a shootout, a car chase, a punch every fucking 3 minutes in The Last Boy Scout. And when they're not doing them things, they're quipping. Whereas in this movie, there's not really any action till right at the end. But that's not really a diss on this movie, because this movie has got a story to tell. The Last Boy Scout hasn't got a story to tell. You know, I'm not being like, that's got more explosions in it, so it's better. I'm just saying.
Ladies and gentlemen, what we found out is that Steve really likes a lot of distractions. Yeah. If you're not going to distract him with something.
If there's no, did a car explode, then it's a shit movie. That's
are the tits are an explosion, I'm going to go to sleep. I'm sorry.
So that's why, in a sense, when I said earlier that I'm kind of like, I'm sort of like...
But we had a good villain in this one, though, too. Sato, I like the guy who played Sato was... I thought he was a great villain. You know, he's sitting there being interviewed in New York, the police station. He knows what's his name's looking. He just does a little nick to the head where you know he cut him. Like, they're just great, delicious moments that he does as a villain.
This does have a lot of moments where it looks like a music video. That's got that.
Well, it's 1987, I mean, what about the opening? Did you not understand?
89, I think. But
I thought it was going to be like a homoerotic video coming up there.
There is a bit of that. So
my name's Michael Douglas.
I'm riding on my hog.
I'm on a motorcycle.
Yeah, you know,
Speaking of hog, baby.
You know, this is not a perfect movie.
Oh, no. But if you look at his early filmography, though, this is like an interesting...
It's an interesting excursion.
Moment for
Ridley
Scott,
also,
exactly.
I couldn't help but think, One, I think Tony Scott should have made this movie.
Obviously, the action would have been quicker. No doubt about that. The pacing would have been faster.
Yeah.
But Scott's got an eye for the California scene, right? And this is a New York movie, so I do think Ridley had the darker feel for the image of the film. You know what I mean?
I'm not really that. I'm just riffing there, where I'm like,
they both are very good directors. I mean, at the end of the day, both brothers are spectacular directors in their own rights.
Both films are elevated by their director. 100%. But I think there was more work to do for Tony. Tony had more work to do. But that, not to diminish what Ridley did. I just mean,
Tony's more of the action director.
Yeah, that's what he is. He's the bubblegum guy, isn't he? He's more bubblegum than Ridley's a bit more like chewing, even more down and dirty, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, you know, Kate Capshaw, a little bit like,
well, she's attractive. I forgot she was in it. Steven Spielberg,
lucky motherfucker,
how did he nab her?
We know how he nabbed her.
I know, but he's not an attractive man
under that beard.
I mean, he's not Michael Douglas.
He ain't no Michael Douglas over here.
He ain't no Dougie Doug over here. He doesn't got a motorcycle.
She's a bit shoehorned in there. She's not much of a character, though.
Well, again, it is one of those characters where you have to kind of have them in. You know, even Halle Berry, same thing. She's there and she's gone quickly.
That's how it was back then. But that's what we're saying in the context of his time. That's why we're in the mess we're in now, with women lead characters being shoehorned in there, where it's clearly got an agenda and all that shit. So,
hey, look, if you're gonna get Spielberg to executive produce, I don't know if he did or not, you put his wife in.
Actually, let me look that up. But at the end of the day, I think for me, both films are equally good. They've both got their problems, and I think they're both successful.
Worth your time.
Yeah. Well, definitely worth. I mean, actually, what a pretty good double bill, actually.
I enjoyed doing it as a double bill, too.
I kind of pretty much did the same thing.
I would say then, if you're a person who enjoys action last, do Black Rain first, then go into Last Boy Scout.
Because it doesn't matter so much if you fall asleep during the Last Boy Scout.
Well,
no, do you know what I mean?
Because you'll get some action. If you go from Last Boy Scout into, they're two different movies. Yeah. We're not giving you two action movies at the same time. Although there's action in
it. But they're both kind of mean and moody, kind of like tough guy stuff, you know?
Like, it's almost like, you know, it's like this guy would have been in John McClane's fucking unit over in New York City. Like, the two of them fucking work together. Right, he's Ronan. Exactly. Like the two of them, you're kind of like, maybe he trained.
John McClane,
kind of, right? Like, it kind of feels like
it. We're in fantasy movie. We're fantasy movie making again. I love it. So yeah.
Let's go to the card.
All right. Well, it is time for us to jump into our showdown. Check the boxes, see who we feel was better at what area in the film. Now, first up is our best action sequences.
Best action sequences.
Now, for me, and I know that the action movie is technically the first one we talked about. However, I actually enjoyed the grounding of our action scenes for Black Rain. So my pick is Black Rain, but based on the grounding of them and not the spectacle of them, if that makes sense. There was a few times I was like, okay, the car jumps, it goes into the pool. I'm like, all right, I've seen this a lot. And I was like, okay.
That doesn't
now,
matter,
my favorite
though.
My favorite parts aren't the action moments. My favorite parts is when it's actually the gritty punching the dude in the fucking nose and killing him right there
the
in the
violence.
Pool. I was like, oh, boom. Yeah. Oh, are you surprised?
No, not really. I'm just making it easy for you.
I enjoyed the Black Rain because the when she gives, I forgot to mention this, the puppet thing, I fucking hated that moment. That could have been cut.
That's funny, like, though. That's funny because the guns in there.
One of my notes we get to talk about is I actually think that.
Where'd you get these guys?
Shane
bad
Black
guys are us and all that. That's funny.
Yeah, Shane Black should have been, but I think he wants to be a comedian. He's always writing jokes.
Oh, well, yeah, that's what he does.
I know, but he should be a comedian. Like, he's got all these jokes. Like, all of a sudden the movie's going on, so we slow down, the bad guy's like, oh, he's going to tell a joke. I'm not going to shoot the guy. He's talking about
You're going off topic.
Anywho, best action sequence for me is Black Rain. And Mr. Smith, I already have an idea where you're going to go, but what is your
choice?
Hang
on a minute.
What action sequence?
You say best action sequence is what we're doing.
Yeah, there's the fight at the end.
Which is the best action sequence then?
Oh, no, we're picking a movie as the best action sequence. That's what we've been doing. We've always picked the best action sequences.
I'll put my crack pipe down.
Hey, look, we're both getting old.
We're tired and emotional.
What you don't know is with one of us, and I won't say who, has already had to pause a little bit to use the bathroom. We can't even make it to recording without someone going to the bathroom. We're
tired. We're emotional. Bear with us. We'll get through it. For me, no, Do you know what?
Fuck you very much.
Hey, over here. Listen, for me, I don't even think there's any question that the best action sequences are in The Last Boy Scout. Simply because of the sheer abundance of them, Tony Scott can direct the fuck out of an action sequence. There's more action in the first 10 minutes of The Last Boy Scout as there is in the whole of Black Rain. You've got to wait an hour and 48 minutes till you even get any action in Black Rain. And I'll be surprised if most people, especially if people of our age, can stay awake that long. That's all I'm saying.
All right. So you're wrong on one, but that's okay. So best supporting characters.
Best supporting characters.
I'm going to go once again with Black Rain. I think there was stronger characters from not only just Andy Garcia, but the Japanese characters, our Japanese stars also were very good in the film. It's a lot more grounded. The best character in Last Boy Scout is hands down Bruce fucking Willis. He is the reason you see that movie. There's a couple fun people coming in and out, but Damon Wayans and my dragging through. I wish we saw more of Hal Barry. Well, that's a discussion for another movie.
But
for me, the best supporting character is definitely Black Rain. For me, Mr. Smith, how say thee?
For me, the best supporting character is in Black Rain, and it's not Andy Garcia. Ken Takakura, his counterpart in Japan.
The police inspector in Japan.
His counterpart in Japan. He's got that dignity, that quiet dignity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't need Damon Wayans because I'm not dissing him like you are, but I think there are enough quips done by Bruce Willis himself.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce Willis is running that show. Like you said, it's a Bruce Willis movie.
Fair enough. I would say Michael Douglas is running that show too.
Oh, agreed.
But you get the cherry on top of Ken Takakura. So I will concede and I will say best support is in Black Rain.
Funniest moments.
Now, funniest moments, there's only one answer, and that's The Last Boy Scout. Because, I mean, let's be honest, it's a dark, gritty crime thriller where there are some funny quips. There are some great quips from Michael Douglas, and they make you laugh.
Agreed.
But for the most of the majority, it's a serious movie. This movie with Bruce Willis, and even when he's telling the jokes, and that gets sometimes a little over the top, but Bruce Willis is on fucking par. Even in the violence, it's dark and humorful. Like when he tells him to fucking, you touch me again, I'll kill you again. And he does it. You laugh because you're not expecting him to put his nose to his fucking brain. Yeah. And you're like, Jesus Christ. You're like, wow, that's great. He's just like, holy shit, that's funny. So yeah, hands down, The Last Boy Scout is the funnier of the movies. I mean, if you have Damon Wayans and it's not funnier, then you close up shop and you go home. It's over with. Although he wasn't funnier than Bruce Willis. That's the sad thing. He's the comedian. He's the professional comedian.
I will say the funnier movie is unquestionably The Last Boy Scout. But I will don my hat to Michael Douglas. A
couple of choice moments for Mike.
The two, you know, the fuck you very much and the I like to get kissed before I get fucked. They're lines I've used my whole life. So special mention to that. But yeah, for me, Last Boy Scout as well.
Most original plot.
Now, more original plot. You probably know I'm going to name, but I thought originally when I was watching The Last Boy Scout, that would be the one I would pick because it would be more original and there'd be more to it. But it ends up just being like a buddy cop movie that we have a great start to because I think so many different fingers messed up this plot, and it just kind of felt like we just got to keep moving from cool scenes, though they may be, in some funny moments. It just felt like your standard buddy cop movie. We're going to get to the end, and the buddies are going to win, and we're going to have a laugh on the way to the sunset. So for me, Black Rain is the more original plot. I would love if there was ever a way, I don't know if it's out there, I should have searched. I would love to read the original Last Boy Scout script.
Yeah.
I would love to see what it could have been. You know what I mean? I would love to see that. So, Steve, your choice.
Yeah, I'm going to say this, Black Rain. I'm going to have to say it's the best plot. I don't think even particularly original. Because the fish out of water teaming up with that's been done a million times as well.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it's a very precise, concentrated plot. Whereas The Last Boy Scout, the plot is secondary. It just is.
Agreed.
But and for me to sit here originally. And be like, oh, mate. No, the script with the police, with the sports corruption and the, you know, no, I could do that. I'd have to try extra hard. to say that with a straight face. So, and I can't, in all good conscience, really. If I'm going to lie, then what's the point? So, yeah, I mean, the plot is secondary to The Last Boy Scout. I mean, you know, it's got, there's a lot going on there because we haven't mentioned.
Oh, there is.
We obviously haven't mentioned that Bruce Willis was a Secret Service.
This is why I would love to see that original script because I would love to see more of that, because that actually.
Yeah, there's something.
Because when you say you're the last Boy Scout, he even says the thing like, oh, you're a real Boy Scout. Like, we would like to see more of why Bruce, but we don't get that.
But we know, we can already probably tell that Joel Silver's probably crossing all that shit out on the script and saying, well, that's going to save us $500,000. So for a more concentrated and, you know, serious plot, there is no question that the Black Rain for me too.
Best action hero.
Now, once again, I feel best action star is a hands down winner. However, I do believe that there is, once again, a person who kind of, you were surprised and should get a nod. So for me, best action star is Bruce Willis in The Last Boy Scout. This is an amazing Bruce Willis film. This one of his best performances next to, as far as an action, next to being John McClane. Like, I forgot how good he was as his character. But I will say, I was surprised. I guess I remember Michael Douglas. You know, I remember the movie, obviously. But now watching the two back-to-back, you're kind of surprised that you don't think of Michael Douglas as a... I mean, I know he's in Romancing the Stone, but that's more of a comedic...
Romantic.
You know, he's more of a farcical... Poor man's Indiana Jones kind of person. You know, he's like, I'm kind of Indiana Jones, but not really.
Yeah, yeah.
I may like to sleep with the ladies more than I like the finding the gems.
Yeah.
But in this one, he kind of stands out as like he had some real fucking... I mean, he could have been a John McClane. He could have easily... I don't know if he'd been as good, but he has some chops that he could have been a John McClane-esque like guy and may have done more, a little bit more action, because he was very convincing in his role and he was able to get the quips and be very believable in them. But he's not the action star that Bruce Willis was in The Last Boy Scout. So to say otherwise is a lie. And it's The Last Boy Scout, Bruce Willis. That's no brainer.
I'm just going to really agree with you that the best is Bruce Willis. Best. Definitely. But when there is action, however, there isn't much. But when there is action in Black Rain, Michael Douglas, he's so good. He's good when it's required.
Yeah.
So it's not like, oh, they didn't do the action in Black Rain because there's no way he could have pulled it off. You know, but there are films where that is the case where it's like, well, no, because that wouldn't work and people wouldn't buy it. No, if there was more action, if he was jumping through rooms with shotguns and shit, just you would have bought it. He's that reliable an actor that, you know, you could pretty much... I mean, look at the range of what he's done over the years. He played Liver Archer.
He did, yeah.
So, you know, yeah, I'm with you that Bruce Willis was the best action hero of the two. But a special mention again, that he's no slouch, Michael Douglas. But he just doesn't get to do that much action in the movie. But like I say, when he does, he's on fire. So Bruce Willis for me.
The better movie.
And we come down to the better movie we feel overall. I think you already know what I'm going to say. However, there's a part of me that wishes there was a world we lived in where we got to see Tony Scott direct Last Boy Scout the way it should have been fucking directed. Like he was able to do 2 years later with True Romance. Because you have an equally talented writer and a young Quentin Tarantino, but you don't have a studio imposing their will on you and changing shit. And it's disappointing because I have a feeling The Last Boy Scout would have been one of those buddy cop action films that would have been better than some of its parts it is currently. Because there is, like you said, there's a lot of great moments. There's a lot of fun stuff. But it is very just like kind of like you don't even like the plot is kind of like I don't even care about the plot. Like you're just there just for like, kinda, like the fun of the ride.
It's episodic.
Yes. Yeah. And you're kind of like you forget that he has a wife for a while and then she like shows up at the end.
Oh, yeah.
You forget about her. You know what I mean? You're kind of like, oh yeah, that's right. I forgot he almost killed this guy because of her. You almost wish the guy he almost kills because Blump, you wish he would stuck around longer because I think it would have been a little bit better. Like Halle Berry, we don't get to know much about her. She gets killed off. And it's almost like we're forced to be like, okay, we're with these two guys. We got to believe that they're going to do this stuff they're doing. And most of the time you believe Bruce and you're like, why is
Dan? Yeah, but he's not his, anyways.
You're kind of just like, I know. So for me, the better movie overall is Black Rain. It's a disappointing. I would love, especially now knowing there's more.
You'd like to be conflicted.
I would. I'm conflicted because I would love to know what it was going to be. But then I'd probably get even angrier because I'd be like, you motherfuckers, you ruined this film, which is probably exactly what happened.
Yeah.
You know, they probably, and when you have both Shane and Tony saying they're disappointed in the film, that tells you that someone interfered with what they were making. And because they didn't go into making this movie being disappointed. They both said, I think this is going to be a good movie. We've got the right people. And look, I think sometimes arguing on set's what you need, because a lot of movies we've heard about where there's been these arguments and stuff on set, like Reservoir Dogs. I know I bring up Tarantino, but like Joe Cabot. Like,
Montana.
This guy lost his mind. You know what I mean? Like, but all this stuff happens and the movie, I
the
think,
energy,
builds because
the energy,
of that. Yes,
it,
the energy
it sap, it,
comes onto screen.
Yeah.
Yes. And so I want to be more conflicted, but I do think Black Rain's the better movie. But that doesn't mean that The Last Boy Scout's not a good movie.
Yeah.
It just, when you find out there could be more and you know how good Bruce was in it, you go, man, I wonder what's been cut on the floor, didn't get put in that we could have really fucking, because there could have been more of those, I'm going to shoot through the door scenes, or I'm going to put my nose through your head scenes. Like, there could have been more of those amazing moments. So for me, Black Rain's the better movie. But if anyone knows of the script out there for Last Boy Scout, the original, or we can get a hold of Shane Black to see if we can see a copy of that, I would love to know what could have been in The Last Boy Scout.
Yeah, I'm going to echo your sentiments, really. I think the better film is Black Rain. I love The Last Boy Scout. I chose The Last Boy Scout. Let's not forget.
And I was glad you did, because I hadn't seen it in a long time. And with us being on this Bruce Willis journey, I really enjoyed getting to watch...
Top tier.
Yeah, like remember the stuff that Bruce gave us. You know, like in those early 90s, you get John McClane, you get this, he's in Pulp Fiction. Like these movies he starts getting, you're kind of like...
Hudson Hawk.
Of course, Hudson Hawk. How can we forget?
But no.
Guess you're not going to be going to the Hat Convention this July.
Hey, you got the right month and everything. Jesus. So...
That's how the movie was made.
no question. I have a very good time watching The Last Boy Scout. I've watched it more often than Black Rain. But I think you've got to just accept that one is operating on a high level, and that movie is Black Rain. So really, pretty much everything you said, really. So yeah, for me, the better movie of the two is Black Rain.
And the winner is... Steve scores the showdown a draw at 3-3, while Scott scores it 4-2. And the winner, by split decision, is Black Rain.
All right, well, there you go. So once again, we have made it down this new journey, and I'm really enjoying it. We've had an opportunity to
watch.
Well, funny thing is, we've rewatched films. Our first stop was we got to watch violent Christmas movies. Then you got to see one I liked. I got to see one you liked. We got to get new films for Christmas that are violent we enjoyed, so we can add to our diehard collection of violent Christmas movies.
Yeah.
And then we got to look back at Schwarzenegger, and now we get to look at the two Scotts. And I'm looking forward to the next month, which we won't give away till the end. I'm glad we took this journey because I'm really enjoying reappraising and watching these films.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, I think some of the reasons we're picking them is we haven't seen them in a long time. And you're kind of
that's
like,
right.
I kind of want to see if they're as good as I remember them. And like, I was a little disappointed last month when The Running Man was not as good as I had remembered. And I was like, damn it, that really didn't hold up the way I thought it was going to hold up. So again, Running Man and Last Boy Scout have real potential. And whether it's the wrong director for The Running Man and someone interfering with the script of The Last Boy Scout, those two films could be bigger marks in the pantheon of cinema than they are. Then they will go down in history as being. And that's a little disappointing.
Yeah, but, you know, we learn.
Hey, that's the way it goes.
That's it, yeah. But they've all been great watches, though.
But you know what's not disappointing, Steve?
Tell me.
The next four movies we're going to induct into our top 100 films.
This is going to be good.
Of all time.
The Cheeky Bastards top 100 films of all time.
Once again, I have the pleasure of leading us off, and a little bit of synergy in this as we were talking about Mr. Tony Scott a little bit, but my number 67th pick, we're going through 67 to 70. We're going to reach number 70 on this month's journey. But for me, this movie comes from 1974. And it is the original, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. Directed by Joseph Sargent and based on the novel of the same name by Morton Friedgood under the pseudonym John Gotti. That's what it's...
Wow.
John Goody, maybe.
Well,
I know it's John Gotti.
I like it.
It's John Gotti.
Keep it to that.
This film, yeah, This film is a gripping and suspenseful tale that revolves around the hijacking of a New York City subway train, Pelham 123, and the subsequent negotiations between the hijackers and the authorities. The strength of this film lies in its tense and well-crafted narrative. The plot unfolds with precision, keeping the audience on the edge of their seats as the events of the hijacked train escalate. The pacing is tight, and the screenplay effectively builds and maintains suspense throughout the film. Adding to its brilliance is its ensemble cast, who deliver memorable performances, with Walter Matthau being the standout as Lieutenant Zachary Garber, the transit police officer tasked with handling the situation. Matthau brings a perfect balance of wit and seriousness to this role, making him a compelling and relatable protagonist. The film also benefits from its authentic portrayal of 1970s New York City. The gritty urban setting adds a layer of realism to the story, and the use of real subway location enhances the film's overall atmosphere. Owen Roizman's cinematography captures the city's energy and chaos, providing a visually stunning and engaging backdrop to the unfolding drama. While the film is a product of its time, with some aspects reflecting the cultural and technological context of the 1970s, its core elements, the gripping plot, strong performances, and effective use of humor have allowed it to endure as a classic in the thriller genre, and it now resides proudly in our top 100 films of all time. And this was the first watch for me last year, early on.
I remember you telling me.
And obviously I watched it for a couple of reasons, because obviously, if you don't know by now, I've said his name enough, but I'm a Tarantino fan, and this is where the colors for Reservoir Dogs got their basis from. So I said, you know what? I got to watch this. I'd seen the remake from Tony Scott, wasn't as impressed. So again, kind of held that as baggage. Why not to see the original? But I said, you know what? We're going to watch it, because I think at the same time, we were also getting ready to record, you and I, Assault on Precinct 13, yes, which I'd only seen the remake of that. So I wanted to see that for the first time. So I was in this old movies, giving them their proper due, and I absolutely loved this movie from start to finish. And ironically, it's on its 50th anniversary this year.
Wow. Fantastic movie.
I know.
Fantastic film.
Spectacular movie. Just because it's in from 1974, this movie will hold you and keep you moving along. I love it. Walter Matthau.
And it's incredibly funny.
It is. Oh, Matthau's phenomenal.
It's not a comedy, yeah, but there is a dark
bit of
humor.
Him talking shit about the Japanese.
Yeah, there's a dark.
And then all of a sudden realize they can speak English.
That's another bit of synergy of with Black Rain.
Yes, one of the great bits and moments in the movie. Yeah. Like, oh, that's great.
Because they do that in that as well, yes. Yeah. Great film.
Well,
great film.
Travolta and obviously Denzel were in
Mind the remake. But you're not going to touch the original. You're not going to touch it. You shouldn't even have made it. I get it. But
it's so, yeah, this is so well-crafted for 1974.
Though.
Yes. Great film. But that is my first induction. Mr. Smith, what is number 68?
Well, from 1955.
This might be the oldest one. I think it is.
Yeah. Right. We're talking Rafifi. Directed by Jules Dassin. Now, I always thought, because it's a French film, I always thought Jules Dassin was French. Dassin sounds like a French name to me, but I digress. Anyway, so Rafifi...
You're Dassin wrong.
Hey! LBU. Listen, Rafifi is a 1955 crime adaptation of Auguste Le Breton's novel of the same name, directed by American blacklisted filmmaker Jules Dassin. The film stars Jean Cervais as aging gangster Tony, Carl Moner as Joe, and Robert Manuel as Mario Ferrati, and also stars Jules Dassin himself as Caesar the Safecracker. The foursome band together to commit an almost impossible theft, the burglary of an exclusive jewelry shop. The centerpiece of the film is an intricate half-an-hour heist scene depicting the crime in detail, shot in near silence, without dialogue or music. And the fictional burglary has been mimicked by actual criminals all over the world. Now, a bit of history here, because this is quite fascinating, really. Now, upon the initial release of the film, it received positive reactions from audiences and critics in France and the UK, earning Jules Dassin the award for Best Director at the 1955 Cannes Film Festival. Now, the film was offered distribution in the United States on the condition that Dassin renounced his past, declaring that he was duped into subversive associations. Otherwise, his name would be removed from the film as the writer and director. Now, Dassin rightfully refused, and the film was released by United Artists, who set up a dummy corporation as the distribution company. The film was finally distributed successfully in America, with Dassin listed in the credits, and in this way, he was the first to break the Hollywood blacklist. Though the film was challenged on release by the Roman Catholic Legion of Decency, The less said about that, the better.
The balls on these fuckers.
The balls on these fucking guys.
Hey, and no pun intended.
Hey, over here. So, anyway, Rafifi was re-released theatrically in both 2000 and 2015 and is highly acclaimed by modern film critics as one of the greatest works in French film noir and has influenced everyone from Stanley Kubrick, Jean-Pierre Melville, Quentin Tarantino, and Steven Soderbergh. Certainly one of the most intense and unique crime dramas of all time, Rafifi now proudly resides among the Cheeky Bastards' top 100 films of all time. And just to add slightly, I'm not sure it's a film noir. It's a crime movie. I think film noirs, a lot of the time, they're just melodramas, really.
Well, if it's French and it's black and white, they're going to name it noir.
True.
Right? If you smoke, yeah, no, if you smoke a cigarette, that, you hold the gun,
but really,
it's noir.
You know, I mean, I love film noir. Touch of Evil, Maltese Falcon, a lot of them. But this is a crime movie through and through. You know, it does away with a lot of the bullshit that slows a lot of these film noirs down. But this is a badass movie, a crime movie, and that the heist movie is one of the most intense things you'll see. I need it in our top 100, and now it's there. So there you go.
It is there. It's number 68.
Ooh.
And I have the pleasure of inducting number 69 over here. And what better movie to induct at number 69? I know you're thinking, is this a porn? No, it's
Last
not.
Tango
it's not
in that, Paris.
But a movie that it feels like it's right. And that's 1990's Goodfellas.
Well.
Directed by Martin Scorsese. This film is a cinematic masterpiece that stands as one of the greatest gangster films ever made. Based on Nicholas Pileggi's book Wise Guy, the film provides a gritty and authentic portrayal of organized crime, exploring the rise and fall of Henry Hill and his associates in the New York mob. Ray Liotta delivers a compelling performance as Henry Hill, taking the audience on a turbulent journey through the highs of criminal success and the inevitable lows of betrayal of one's downfall. What sets Goodfellas apart is Scorsese's dynamic direction and innovative storytelling techniques. The use of voiceover narration, frenetic editing, and an iconic soundtrack contribute to the film's immersive and visceral experience. The famous long tracking shot through the Copacabana nightclub is a testament to Scorsese's mastery as a cinematic technician, showcasing his ability to blend style and substance seamlessly. The supporting cast is fucking exceptional over here, with Joe Pesci's portrayal of Tommy DeVito earning him an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. What, I'm here to amuse you? Robert De Niro's performance as James Jimmy Conway adds depth to the narrative, and the chemistry among the main cast members is palpable, creating a believable and engrossing portrayal of the mob lifestyle. Goodfellas doesn't romanticize the criminal world. Instead, it exposes the brutality, moral ambiguity, and eventual consequences of a life of crime. The film's exploration of themes such as loyalty, betrayal, and the corrosive effects of power adds layers of complexity to the characters and elevates it beyond a typical gangster film. Goodfellas is a timeless classic that continues to resonate with audiences, praised for its bold storytelling, exceptional performances, and the lasting impact it has had on the crime genre. It remains a cinematic achievement that has left an indelible mark on the history of filmmaking, and it now takes its rightful place in our top 100 films of all time in the number 69 position over here. What am I here to fucking amuse you? I'm a fucking clown. Love this movie. As you know, first episode
that's
of this
right.
podcast.
And you were wrong. We and discussed, that's the episode you were wrong on.
And I've been right the entire time since, you son of a bitch. Get your shine box.
No.
It's a spectacular film. It's one of those films that when it does come on, you are sucked in.
Yeah. I was about to say, if you ever don't know what movie to watch, just put Goodfellas on.
Yes, yes. It's great storytelling. It's an amazing film. It just really is. It's a spectacular film. If you didn't think it was going to be in the top 100, go fuck yourself.
I was waiting. It had to happen. Because I didn't know what two you were going to choose tonight. So
and I was like, oh, I get to do 69. I was like, Goodfellas the one this month. Bada-bing. Over here. Mr. Smith, you will now have the honor of inducting number 70. As we have reached 70, we have 30 to go, but we have reached number 70 in our top 100 films of all time.
Well, to end things, you know, on a bloody note, keeping on the world cinema vibe for this episode of my choices. From 2010, directed by the insane Takeshi Miike, we have 13 Assassins. Now, a remake of a 1963 film by Ichi Kudo. 13 Assassins is a 2010 period film from director Takeshi Miike. The setting is feudal Japan, 1844. Lord Naritsuga Matsudara
well
is the younger brother of the Shogun, which affords him the unchallenged right to murder, rape, torture, and mutilate on a whim. After a high-ranking official protests Narasuga's latest outrage by publicly committing suicide, a conspiracy is formed within the Shogun's senior council to eliminate Narasuga before his madness plunges the entire nation into anarchy. A veteran samurai named Shinzamon is recruited to accomplish the suicidal task, assembling a ragtag group of 12 warriors plus one enigmatic vagrant for one last chance at an honorable death in an age of peace. They quickly transform a sleepy little village into a booby trap-laden killing ground, preparing to ambush their target before he reaches the safety of his estate. But even with surprise and skill on their side, can the small group of assassins possibly hope to prevail against Naritsugu's private army of more than 200 soldiers? Notorious for his 45-minute action-packed finale, Miike reins in his usual sadistic and weird-as-fuck sensibilities to deliver a film that the British Film Institute rank in the top 10 samurai films of all time, and now resides in the Cheeky Bastards' top 100 films of all time.
I mean, if the BFI rank it, we rank it.
Hey.
There you go.
It's a classic. It's got it all. And that 45-minute action sequence at the end is just an exercise in just precision of planning, you know, and the how that was all patched together through the editing. It has got early in the film, there are a few Miike touches of kind of extreme kind of sadism and fucked up weird shit. I mean, you know, he made Itchy the Killer audition, you know, this guy is, he's made some pretty insane shit. But he does really rein it in. And, you know, it's like, you know, this has been done, you know, before. This is like Seven Samurai, Magnificent Seven, etc. It's just, well, it's perfect. You know, it sets all the characters up and it sets the plot up perfectly. And then it's like you've been waiting for a big action sequence and it just goes all out at the end and just delivers it perfectly. So, yeah, that's my choice. That's my final choice for this month.
So there you have it. Our four in for this month of February 2024. From 1974, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. From 1955, Rafifi. From 1990, Goodfellas. And from 2010, 13 Assassins.
That will do it for another action-packed movie showdown. Now you can join in on the debate and let us know who you had as the winner of this month's head-to-head cinematic battle by following the show on all its socials. Those links can be found in our show notes. And be sure to join us again in 2 weeks for our latest episode of Dropping a Bruce, available, just like this podcast, exclusively on the Last of the Action Heroes Podcast Network, where you can find other amazing shows dedicated to such iconic action stars as Stallone, Lundgren, Van Damme, Schwarzenegger, and Seagal. The link to the network can also be found in the show's notes. We hope you'll drop in again next month as we pit two Jean-Claude Van Damme action flicks against one another as 1994's Time Cop squares off against 1993's Hard Target for Van Damme's supremacy. So until then, stay explosive, my friends.
This has been a Man with an Exceptional Beard production.